Two threads for us today. One, globalization. Two, it's all about the brand, baby. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 23rd day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We have spent a lot of time these past 4 weeks talking about some of the fairly specific ramifications of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Sanctions and commodities, supply chains and food prices. What we haven't done much of is the big picture stuff. What all of this might mean for the global economic system as a whole. So we're going to do that today. Adam Posen is the president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics, also most recently the author of a piece in Foreign Affairs about the invasion and that global economy, the headline of which is The End of Globalization. Adam, welcome to the program. Good to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Do me a favor, would you, and give me the thumbnail sketch of globalization as you see it before the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah, before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, for the last several years, globalization's been what I call corroding, as opposed to, say, the height of globalization, which I would put around 2000, when everything was sort of open to everybody. And I think there's two things behind it. It's politics and – sorry.
Well, no, I was just going to ask you, give me a couple of for instances. What's going on that globalization, which has been the economic force, as you say, of the last two decades, has now started to corrode?
I think there are two major forces. One is in the U.S., Kai, for 20 years, there's been a lot of anti-globalization politics. And so we were becoming more and more unwelcoming to immigrants, doing fewer trade deals. The other thing, which is widely recognized, is China decided to pursue its own path, but tried to do so while still part of the global economy. And that presented a lot of challenges for people, for good reason.
Okay. Then we have the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which, to be clear, you point out was the ethically, morally, and just in every single way, right thing to sanction Russia about and try to exclude them from large parts of the global economy. But you say it will make that corrosion of globalization worse. How?
Right. In my view, the corrosion gets accelerated because, first, you have a bunch of countries, including China, watching what the U.S. and its allies are doing to the Russian economy and basically saying all your assets are worthless because we're not going to let you buy anything with them. You're not going to get access to all the organizations and all the financial networks and even technology. And that's really scary for people. And even if the rest of the world says it's justified in this case, but what happens when Trump or for that matter Biden says, you know, I don't like you, your regime, I'm going to go after you. A second thing that goes on is that people have been worried a lot over the last few years for good reason about supply chains. And one reason you're worried about supply chains is interruptions because of earthquakes or storms. But another reason you're worried is about geopolitical risk. And so I may have to build redundancies, essentially pay for expensive insurance, that I can get these goods or make these production decisions someplace that's geopolitically safe. And so those two factors, those are going to drive further the corrosion of globalization.
What, though, Adam, are the costs of that corrosion? Because if I am trying to get by, whether in this economy or another one, going to work, raising my kids, paying my mortgage, doing my job, how does that impact me?
Oh, it's the right question, obviously. First off, people are seeing more inflation because of the energy disruption. But over the medium term, meaning 2, 3, 4, 5 years out, what we're going to see is less variety of goods. And I don't mean just how many cereal boxes. I mean, like, what kinds of cars, what kinds of communication equipment. You're going to see more expensive products because even if companies and governments are rational to build and relocate these resilient connections or bring stuff home, as President Biden sometimes says, that's just going to raise prices. A third thing that happens is in a world that's more divided and more politically uncertain, you end up trapping people's savings. The American savings or the European savings get allocated around the world, and that helps even the average saver So run that in reverse. We're scared of putting money into China. We're not allowed to put money into Russia. That's going to drive down the return savers get, and it's going to reduce diversification. So you're more at risk.
Let me ask you the geopolitical question here, because you've got a great line, and I'm going to quote you back to myself. You know, President Biden has gotten a lot of praise from many quarters for leading the allies in Europe, who, you know, can be a fractious bunch, to generally stick together to put these sanctions into place. But one of the things you say is that one of the corrosions, I guess, that might come out of this is that other countries might fear being subjected to Washington's economic power. And here's your quote: now that it, Washington, is re-enamored with its apparent power. So this is at least in part about what the Americans are doing.
Yeah. The economic realities are, if we decide you're a national security threat or we just don't like you, we can cut you out of the financial system for decades, like we did Cuba, Venezuela, North Korea, Iran. And now we are even willing to do it to a nuclear power that exports energy like Russia. People are going to around the world say, well, I have to protect against that. I can't count on that. And I think that's going to have a chilling effect, frankly, on growth in the developing countries.
We have learned over the past month that peace in Europe, even though we had it for 75, 80 years, is not a sure thing. We thought globalization was a sure thing. And now you make the point that maybe it's not. Is this corrosion a sure thing, or can what's happening that you describe be reversed?
I think at a minimum, it can be offset. So I think the biggest thing is to build on the alliance that came together against the Russian invasion, strengthen the integration of our economy so you get some scale, some freedom, some diversification. And that also has the benefit of putting more competition within our world. So I think it's important to create a market of the democracies as far as we can get it, as deep as we can get it. And it's got to be with people and ideas as well as just stuff.
Adam Posen, writing recently in Foreign Affairs about the war on globalization and what the future might hold. He is the president by day of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Adam, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
On Wall Street today, not so great, actually, but I'll tell you what, you want not so great? Keep your eye on the Moscow Stock Exchange, set to partially reopen tomorrow after being closed for a month. We will have the stateside details when we do the numbers. All right, so let's go a little bit deeper, a little bit more specific, I guess, into the geopolitics of the global economy that I was talking to Adam Posen about just then. This week, the Biden administration and the Brits made a deal to remove most of the remaining Trump-era tariffs on each other's imports. There was a similar deal not too long ago to lift tariffs on steel and aluminum coming here from Japan and the EU. As Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman tells us, it's not so much a wholesale shift in trade policy that's driving those changes as it is the politics.
The new trade deal is nice for British steel and aluminum producers who will get to sell into the U.S. at more competitive prices, and for U.S. companies that will be able to export more motorcycles, blue jeans, and whiskey to the U.K. tariff-free. Jennifer Hillmans with the Council on Foreign Relations.
The Biden administration has worked very hard to remove a number of the significant trade irritants between the UK and the United States, the EU, Japan, and the United States, saying to these countries, you are among our favored trading partners, and therefore you are getting a better deal.
An important detail in the recent trade deals is that U.S. tariffs are being replaced with import quotas, says Syracuse University economist Mary Lovely.
So there will still be restrictions on how much steel can come into the United States. And that meets the Biden administration's goal of supporting workers in the industry.
Meanwhile, the administration hasn't pushed forward to negotiate sweeping free trade deals that our allies want. Lovely says what's driving trade relations is primarily the foreign policy goal of strengthening the international coalition against Russia. Meanwhile, there's been no de-escalation in the Trump-era tariff war with China, says Doug Redeker at the Brookings Institution.
The phase one tariffs were widely condemned by then candidate and now President Biden. And yet those tariffs remain in place, virtually untouched.
Redeker says the Biden administration has yet to fully articulate, let alone execute, a comprehensive policy to strengthen the U.S. economic alliance in Asia and counter China's growing power. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The funding bill that President Biden signed earlier this month, $1.5 trillion to keep this government going, also had about $13.5 billion for Ukraine, money for military equipment and logistics, also food and health care for people displaced by that war. International aid groups are putting a lot of money into the region as well, and people and organizations and countries want to help, of course, but they also want to get credit for helping. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has that one.
Jude Moore spent nearly a decade working in the Liberian government. He says the country receives billions of dollars in foreign aid. And when you drive around the Liberian countryside, it's clear that it does.
It's dueling signs for every government, non-governmental organization that's providing any kind of aid. It's a crazy thing.
The American government has a law passed in 1961 that requires aid purchased with American funds to have a specific label, says Jacob Kurtzer with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
That says, from the American people. There's a little flag logo that we put on all the materials that lets the recipients of foreign assistance know who paid for it.
Kurtzer knows that logo. The government is one of his organization's sponsors, too. And lots of countries claim credit for the blankets and boxes of food they provide as aid, as do international organizations. Jeff Crisp is with Oxford and worked for the UN Refugee Agency for more than two decades. He says that organization has a kind of brand book,
which is almost obsessional in the detail it goes into as to how you can portray the logo, what size it must be, what shape it must be, what color it must be.
Chris says this labeling of goods is old-fashioned, as is giving goods at all. More organizations are moving towards giving cash to refugees. Old-fashioned or not, that need to claim credit is understandable, says Jude Moore, who worked in Liberia. But he says in Ukraine, it'll be important to let the government take ownership of its work.
When the war ends and the Ukrainians are rebuilding, it is important for them to be able to see the government they elected as the one doing things for them.
Moore says rebuilding infrastructure is the easy part. Rebuilding trust in government is much harder. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It was this oasis.
Sounds nice, I'll tell you what. First, though, let's do the numbers. All right, so this is less nice. Dow Industrial's down 448 today, almost 1.3%, closed at 34,358. The NASDAQ gave up 186, also 1.3%, 13,922. S&P 500 shed 55 points, 1.2%, finished at 44.56. Oil prices back up today. Brent crude, that's the global benchmark, right over $120 a barrel, which is good news for big oil. Chevron added a little bit more than 1%. ExxonMobil pocketed just shy of 1.6%. ConocoPhillips rose more than 2.5%. Bond prices went up. That means yields go the other way. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.29%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. $4.23 for a gallon of gas. That is the AAA national average. More in some places, obviously less in others, but still a lot, and it's putting the squeeze on a specific category of workers in this economy who are more price-sensitive than most. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has been talking to some rideshare and food delivery drivers.
Anthony Ariano has bounced between rideshare and food delivery apps in Los Angeles for the last few years, driving for whichever one gets him the most money. And recently, gas prices have become a big part of the equation.
It's definitely cut into my margins. Like, I feel like at least a day's worth of earnings is going just directly towards gas.
He recently switched to grocery delivery to cut down on his mileage. Now he's looking for jobs that don't require so much driving.
To just find a place where I can just go to work and just only worry about commuting.
The apps have taken steps to mitigate some of the extra costs for drivers. Uber, Lyft, and Instacart are charging consumers an extra 40 to 55 cents each ride. But that might not be enough, says Sergio Avidian with the Rideshare Guy blog.
When headwinds like this show up, like the pandemic did, or the gas prices now, people are not dumb anymore. They just quit.
A Rideshare Guy survey earlier this month found rising gas prices had caused more than half of drivers to either cut back their hours or quit. And that's bad for business. Uber says the number of active drivers has held steady, but if gas prices stay high, they could threaten the industry, says Sam Abu El Samid, an analyst with Guidehouse Insights.
It's always been tricky to actually try to make money on this.
Uber and Lyft narrowly achieved operating profits for the first time last year, but it took raising prices for consumers. With people more comfy on transit and in restaurants now, Abu El Samid says there's not a lot of wiggle room to raise prices again. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
That big spending bill I mentioned setting up Stephanie Hughes a minute ago also adds $200 million to something called the Housing Choice Voucher Program. It's better known, perhaps, as Section 8, the federal program that subsidizes housing for more than 2 million low-income households in this economy. Right now, though, only about 1 in 4 households that are eligible actually get a voucher, and in a lot of cities, the wait list is years long. And those cities include Baltimore, where Marketplace's Amy Scott looked at what happens when one family finally got off that list.
5 years ago, Kiera Bulware was working part-time, making minimum wage, and struggling to provide for her baby daughter, Brooklyn. So she applied for a housing choice voucher to help pay the rent, and then kind of forgot about it.
You know, you get on the waiting list, you just wait, and so they call you.
While she waited, her roommate moved out, and Bulware couldn't pay the rent on her own. She and Brooklyn moved in with Bulware's parents for a while. It didn't work out.
And we were officially homeless. We would stay at different people's houses. We stayed in the hotel for a long time. Even some nights, like, I would drop her off at, like, my aunt's house, and then I would, like, sleep in my car.
Then, more than 2 years after she first applied, Bulware got an email from the Baltimore Regional Housing Partnership. She was next in line for a voucher. She didn't believe it at first.
It was a weekend, so I couldn't call until that Monday to make sure that it was real.
It was real, but the voucher came with some strings attached. Baltimore's is one of a handful of housing mobility programs. Bulware would have to take a series of workshops on financial literacy, home maintenance, landlord-tenant relations, and she would have to move from her distressed neighborhood in East Baltimore to a neighborhood with better access to jobs, services, and highly rated schools. Adria Crutchfield is executive director of the Baltimore Regional Housing Partnership. She says research has shown that children in similar programs had better outcomes.
Those children were more likely to attend college, less likely to become single parents, more likely to earn more as adults compared to those who continue to live in high poverty neighborhoods.
But limited funding means only so many families can make that move. Crutchfield says more than 14,000 households are waiting for one of just over 4,000 vouchers her program provides. Will Fisher is director of housing policy and research at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which recently analyzed voucher waitlists around the country.
And we found over 700,000 families on these waiting lists just at the 44 agencies that we were able to look at.
The budget Congress passed earlier this month provides funding for 25,000 new rental vouchers, along with $25 million to help voucher holders move to areas with more opportunity through counseling and other services. Fisher says on their own, vouchers have been shown to reduce homelessness, overcrowding, and evictions.
If they're paired with these services, they're even more effective in broadening choice for families and giving kids access to additional opportunities.
But moving away from family and friends to take advantage of those opportunities isn't easy. The Baltimore program provides counseling to help families find housing and adjust to their new communities. Not everyone stays after the required 2 years. Kiera Bulware has. She first received her voucher almost 3 years ago. Today, she and Brooklyn live in Odenton, Maryland, a Baltimore suburb. When she first arrived, it was so quiet, she'd call her aunt in the city and complain about being bored.
And she was like, you are not bored, you're at peace.
Now that they've settled in, she likes the quiet. She writes urban fiction in her spare time. On a recent evening, Bulware sat at her desk helping Brooklyn play a math game on her phone.
How many is that?
10.
Exactly. So it's 9 plus 1. So you have to make that into a plus sign.
Brooklyn, who's now in kindergarten, has a learning disability. And Bulware says she's made tremendous progress at her school.
The opportunities that are going to be afforded to her by going to a higher rated school where everything is hands-on, everyone's helping her, I think that very much benefits her.
So does having stable housing. When Brooklyn came down with a bad case of COVID in December and couldn't go to school for several weeks, Bulware quit her job as a community health worker to stay home with her. And because the subsidy she gets with her voucher adjusts for a loss of income, the rent still got paid. In Odenton, Maryland, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Stephanie Hughes was talking a minute ago about corporate brands and how important they can be, forget just for business, but for bigger picture stuff too. Geopolitics, once again, is what I'm thinking about here. You don't find too many brands too much more wrapped up in geopolitics than McDonald's. The burger chain has temporarily closed its 850 stores in Russia, but back in the day, it was one of the first American brands to set up shop in Moscow. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab takes us back.
It's the winter of 1990 in the Soviet Union. It's cold, it's dark, food supply is unreliable. And in the middle of Moscow's Pushkin Square, the golden arches are glowing.
And it was this oasis, brightly lit, colorful.
At the time, Eileen Kane was an American studying at Moscow State University. Now she teaches modern Russian history at Connecticut College. She says she ate McDonald's a few times a week because there wasn't always enough food at her dorm. Her American dollars made McDonald's accessible. But for the average Russian, buying a Big Mac was a stretch.
You would see people standing in line, you know, wearing fur coats, you know, beautifully made up on a date. It was an outing.
At the time, eating out in Russia was such a luxury that McDonald's was among some people's first experiences at a restaurant. Konstantin Sonin grew up in Russia and was 18 at the time. He teaches political economics at the University of Chicago. During his first visit to McDonald's, he got French fries. He says the fast food chain was unlike anything the Soviet Union had experienced before. It was clean, the service was friendly, and the packaging was all styrofoam, paper, and plastic.
In the Soviet Union, plastic bags were a kind of a very rare thing. So everything disposable was an unusual thing and an unusual concept.
He says even though Russians had an anti-American attitude, they looked at McDonald's with so much hope.
They were looking at this as a window to just a different world. It was certainly the beginning of a happier Russia.
True, McDonald's wasn't affordable, but it felt democratic. For instance, it only accepted rubles, while many other restaurants prioritized more valuable forms of currency. And it helped Russians feel like change was coming. The Soviet Union dissolved just 2 years later. Miguel Centeno is a professor of sociology at Princeton and has studied globalization by mapping McDonald's.
We forget, 30 years ago, McDonald's was a symbol of modernity, and that you have enough of an economy, enough of a society to be able to sustain it.
And sustain it they did, growing to 850 locations. Konstantin Sonin says McDonald's decision to temporarily close them earlier this month is a big blow.
I think a lot of people consider this explicitly as the country moving backwards.
Sonin says those who weren't alive back then are getting a peek at what living in Russia was like during the Cold War. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the West, broadly speaking, is still buying a lot of Russian oil and gas. We have talked about that. The global energy trade is denominated in dollars. It's the world's reserve currency. We have talked about that, too. Vladimir Putin, though, is starting to talk rubles. The Associated Press reports that Putin has issued instructions to make, quote, unfriendly, unquote, countries, they know who they are, I suppose, pay for their Russian natural gas in rubles. No timeline. Also, probably no chance it's going to do what he wants, which is raise the value of the now greatly devalued Russian currency. All right, we got to go. Too much me talking today. No time for a moment of economic context. Find your own. My apologies. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe. Maybe I'll do two tomorrow. I don't know. Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.